Each year in my government class for high school seniors, we start the government class with this two-week session of defining political greatness and personal greatness. And we look at George Washington, because I love George Washington. So we look at his documents, and it's an intense time of critical thinking. For 2 weeks, we do this. Then after this 2 weeks of intense critical thinking, I go to the board and I draw stick figures. Because simplicity, I've often found, brings the greatest clarity and understanding. So bear with me if you're more artistic. This is Sue. And Sue has a thought. And this thought that Sue has, think about it. She kind of likes her thought. She tries it out in her mind a little bit. She compares it with some other thoughts she's had, and yeah. She might even discuss it with somebody else. She compares it with things she's heard, and pretty soon, she thinks she's right about her thought. And now, Sue's thought has actually become a belief. She believes what she was thinking. And that belief, now that her thought has become, motivates Sue to some action. Now, that belief that Sue had translates itself. I mean, it affects words that she says. It affects places that she goes. It affects things that she does. Sue's thought, which became a belief, which translated an action, became repeated actions. And now, not only does Sue have thought, belief, action, it actually defines who Sue is. It's her character. Because the Bible tells us in Proverbs 23:7, for as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. But Sue doesn't live alone in the world. No man or woman does. Nobody's an island. And so now the things that Sue says, other people are saying. The way she dresses, other people are mimicking. The places she's going, all of that, she's affecting now and having an influence on, guess what the last word is? Culture. She's having an influence on her culture because the things that she said influenced others, right? Iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpeneth the countenance of his friend. Sue's thinking, which became her belief, affected her action, which became her character, and then influenced her culture. But let's go back to Sue's thought a minute. What if the thought Sue had was wrong or evil? You know what happened. If she accepted that wrong thought or belief or idea, it became a belief, which translated itself into bad actions, which became wrong character, which was a wrong influence, and caused a bad culture. Once again, the Bible just simply says, be not deceived. Evil communications corrupt good manners. Conversely, what if Sue's thought is good or right? And when she has the thought, she compares it with Scripture and it's the same. Now, we all know she's got a good thought, which becomes a righteous belief, and her actions are right, which makes for right character, and now she's influencing the right culture. The Bible tells us there, he that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed. What's really cool to me about all of this is that her thought, right thought, which became a right belief, and action, which translated into her character and influenced the culture, can also influence a nation, right? Righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. It all started with an individual who had a thought, pretty powerful. The influence of one man or woman or high school senior, or third grade boy. Each of those individuals have far-reaching influences. Don't minimize that third grade boy's influence. But let's go back to Sue. What if Sue's thought, she's just not thinking? What if she doesn't really think? Her thoughts aren't evil or righteous. What if she just goes around kind of zombie-like? What's the result of thoughtlessness? Mindlessness. Do we have anybody like that? Perhaps violent action like that I was talking about in the beginning illustration? Violent action just because not even thinking about what we're doing. Is it possible that today we have a mindless or a thoughtless culture? What is culture anyway? Well, ninth grade geography book says that culture is a man's way of life. Online dictionary tells us that culture is the beliefs, customs, practices, and social behavior of a particular group of people. Just like a football team, don't they have a distinct culture? I mean, they're unique. I'll leave it alone at that, okay? But so does our classroom. Our classroom has a culture. And today, we're trying to learn how to create a culture of biblical excellence. So to do so, we need to define some terms, okay? So what is excellence? What would you say?
Something great.
You know what? That's exactly what I put right away. Something great, okay? Something which surpasses ordinary standards. Okay? But what is biblical excellence? Let's start with a generalization. We could say biblical excellence is following God's standard of greatness, right? Because that's how we defined excellence in the first place. Well, in fact, if we look in Scripture, excellence is personified. I love last night's service. From beginning to end, from the songs to the dramatic reading to the message, all of it, we heard how excellence is personified. In Scripture, God himself personifies excellence. Isn't that awesome? His word declares his excellent majesty, power, name, loving kindness, greatness, brightness. But God's word also articulates an excellence individualized. The Bible speaks of individuals having an excellent spirit, excellent speech, excellent understanding, a more excellent way, a more excellent sacrifice and wisdom. Now let's get even more specific to our topic. When we're looking at creating a culture of biblical excellence, we're looking at excellence in a Christian school, right? So the specification is following God's standard of greatness in a Christian school. So what is our purpose? I think most of us would say the purpose of school is to learn, right? We want the students to learn. That's the goal. I like this definition. Dr. James DeWink from Bob Jones University said this. The purpose of Christian education is to cause young men and women to be conformed to the image of Christ in their thoughts and actions. That's a pretty good definition. Last year at our school, Brother Lee, our administrator, had as our theme, practice his presence. I love that thought. Because before you can practice his presence, you have to think about him. What would God want from our school? Pastor Chappell said it again this morning. We want what God would want, students with a heart for God. How many times have you heard that? We want students with a heart for God. We might add, with a will to work, with a mind to learn. But what does that mean? What does have a heart for God mean? Didn't Jeremiah say that the heart is desperately wicked? Who can know it? The dictionary says that the heart is the seat of our emotions. So when we say we want students with a heart for God, does that just mean we want students that have this emotional bent or pull or tug toward God? Is that all we want? With students with a heart for God? Have you ever noticed somewhat of a disconnect with our students? Students who say they have a heart for God, but routinely fail to turn in their assignments. Students who faithfully sing in the choir or play in the orchestra, outwardly demonstrating what we would think is a heart for God, but unconcernedly come late to school. Students who say they have a heart for God but disrupt our class, show disrespect to a teacher or a fellow classmate. Students who will eagerly work in the nursery or in a Love Works program, yet are just lackadaisical when it comes to class participation or content to maintain mediocrity. What does it really mean to have a heart for God? Do our students mistakenly equate a love for God with a certain set of behaviors without really ever believing or accepting God's standard of righteousness? If you look at the top of your notes, you'll find Philippians 1, 8 through 11, where Paul writes and he says, "For God is my record, how greatly I long after you all in the bowels of Jesus Christ. And this I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more in what? In knowledge and in all judgment, that ye may approve things that are excellent, that ye may be sincere and without offense till the day of Christ." This is the love that he's talking about. It's not some just emotional bent towards something. It's a love of knowledge and judgment, approving with God's standard of excellence. And then Paul says, being filled with the fruits of righteousness, which are by Jesus Christ unto the glory and praise of God. A heart for God thinks about, internalizes, and believes or accepts God's standard of righteousness in all things. Then righteous actions and character and godly influence follow. This seems kind of elementary, but the more I teach, the longer I live, I'm convinced that philosophy is most important. What a person really thinks and believes, or conversely, when a person fails to think, affects their destiny. So, what are we teaching, or what are we thinking about this summer? We've got 3 months before school. What are we thinking about? It's summer vacation. Now, what are we thinking about? What are our students thinking? Are any of us thinking? We're attempting to be specific. So what would God want for our school? Here at LBS, we made a list of objectives for us. I put them on poster board because I want to be able to refer to them several times when I change the PowerPoint. So here they are, and I'm going to put them up here briefly. Number one, students should acquire and comprehend a fundamental general body of knowledge. They need to know H2O is water. 8 times 4 is? How do you know that? Okay, obviously it's a general body of knowledge, right? Okay. Students should internalize and apply biblical principles. We don't want them just to memorize a verse. We want them to know what the verse means, right? Understand, internalize, and apply it. Students, now be careful on this one. Look at the words carefully. Students should consciously and subconsciously engage in critical thinking and capably apply, analyze, synthesize, evaluate, and create. Number 4. Are you laughing because this is hard to come up with? It's hard to acquire this goal? Yeah, me too. Number 4, students should be articulate speakers and writers. Do we need that? Oh my, do we need that. Last one. Students should develop these academic objectives alongside their development of musical, physical, and social abilities to fulfill their life's purpose, to bring glory to God. Those are some pretty high ideals. Would you think that's what God would want our school to look like, though? How are we doing? Objectives are nice written statements. But are we weak in any of these areas? If these would be God's objectives for our school, I believe a culture of biblical excellence would be characterized by teachers, students, and parents who are all consciously aware of these goals and seeking to attain them. They would be a driving force, a passion behind everything that was related to school. Every school-related activity would have these in the background. Do our students even know that we have any objectives? I want to pause for a moment, because here at LBS, and I would assume at your school as well, there are many great students. I mean, I'm thinking of them even as I say that. Many who consistently do right, purposefully excel academically and spiritually. But can we say that overall at our school, there's a culture of learning that epitomizes biblical excellence? Could we do better? Should we do better? A couple of years ago at our high school graduation, the valedictorian gave a speech. It was a great speech. But she made a statement that has haunted me ever since. This intelligent student, she's valedictorian, said that she liked government class because Mrs. Demergen made her class think. Then she said, "That was the first time we ever really had to do that." What? Alarm bells went off in my head. I had those students as freshmen. I had those students as sophomores. I never made them think then. Mrs. Jones had them in English. Mrs. Tax told me, Brother Coates, nobody made them think before second semester of their senior year? I doubt that. But wait a minute. I wondered why this conscientious student thought and made that statement as a fact at the culmination of her education in high school. Is it possible that at the core of this student's comment, there's actually a foundational truth that could make a difference in our school culture? As I've contemplated the statement throughout the last couple of years, I believe that a key component is that word, thinking. I, as a teacher, have to start out thinking about what I want to accomplish. Then I have to help my students consciously know that I'm helping them think. They have to be aware that there's this thinking process. There's a great book out right now called Making Thinking Visible. Make Thinking Visible. What can we do to create or foster a school culture of biblical excellence where there's really thinking going on? A place where teachers, parents, and students are all consciously seeking to attain our biblical objectives. Think about a specific class that you taught last year. Look at the objectives. Everybody got a class in your mind? Okay. What percentage of your students reached those objectives appropriate to their grade level in your class? Don't say it out loud, but think it. What did you do to encourage the attainment of such ideals? Did you demonstrate that you were consumed with a passionate desire for them to reach a goal? Could you do better? Yeah, me too. How? Will we? It's crucial for us to stop and think about what we want to accomplish, but we also have to have some practical implementation, right? So let's look at some action. What can we do to create a culture of biblical excellence? First of all, we can model excellence. How can we model excellence? I'm glad you asked. Know God. Remember what we said a minute ago? Every teacher needs to know God, not simply about him or what he's done in the life of somebody else, but have a personal relationship with him. Nothing can replace a personal relationship with the God of the universe, in whom are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Will you stop and think about that? If I have a personal relationship with the God of the universe, I'm going to have access to all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. I won't be able to teach without mentioning him. He'll be paramount in my thoughts. My students will recognize my passion for him. They'll wonder about my passion for him. And they'll consciously start desiring something like that. Some kind of a relationship like that. He is that good. We model excellence when we know God, because he personifies excellence. What else can we do? How can we model excellence? Know your subject. Get up early, stay up late, do whatever it takes to know your material before you reach your classroom. Anybody recognize this book, The Seven Laws of Teaching? Oh, it's an old one. 1885, it was published by John Milton Gregory. I used it in college. Anybody else use it in college? Yeah. It's been updated. It's great. The truths are timeless. You know what the first law of teaching is? I challenge you to get this book this summer and just go back through it. The first lesson, first law of teaching by John Milton Gregory is the teacher must know that which he would teach. If a teacher knows his lesson, he won't feel subservient to his textbook. If a teacher knows her lesson, she can watch the efforts of her class. She can look right in their eyes, as Dr. R. mentioned last hour. She can come up with questions that will encourage their thinking. She can see if they're awake or not. If the teacher knows what she will teach. Gregory also said this, a teacher's ready and evident knowledge helps to give the pupil needed confidence. Now, what does that mean? Oh, that student will feel good about asking a question of a teacher who knows answers. They won't bother if you don't know your subject. If you know your subject, the students who walk into your classroom, they're going to have confidence, and you're going to help create a culture of excellence. In our discussion of the law of the teacher, though, I should say, Gregory also, at the end of each chapter, shows teachers who violate the laws. You know, the teacher who doesn't know his subject matter doesn't really prepare because he doesn't think his students will notice. Or the teacher's busy the night before and says, you know, I just have to have enough material that I can cover the 40 minutes of the class period. Or the pompous, lazy teacher who says, oh, I know so much about that subject, I just really can't stop and talk about it right now. Really? Let's create a culture of excellence by knowing our subject. Know God. Know your subject. But how else can we model excellence? No more than you did last year. What is on your reading list for this summer? Last summer, I read the autobiography of Sonia Sotomayor. She's one of the newest judges on the Supreme Court. It's very intriguing. I learned a lot about affirmative action because her life really is the product of affirmative action. I've taught affirmative action for years. Now I have a different viewpoint that I can show two different viewpoints in my classroom and have better critical thinking in my classroom and debate and topic of conversation that really requires critical thinking, analysis, and evaluation. Be excited about what you're reading and learning. If you learn, Dr. R. said, teach from the overflow. Take in all this new information. I have this whole list of books I'm reading this summer. I'm rereading this one, How Ronald Reagan Changed My Life. I'm loving it. I'm reading a book right now, the autobiography of, it's not the autobiography, the biography of Amy Carmichael. Oh, wow, it's a convicting and awesome book that I'm going to use in my classroom next year. Be so excited about what you learn this summer that you can't help but start teaching about it the first day of class. Now I know you can't go into some deep subject on the first day of class, but if you go in excited and passionate, those students will notice it. They might think you're a little odd, but they'll be attracted to the passion. They will be. I've seen it over and over. They're attracted to the passion about your subject, and you will have helped to create a culture of excellence. So get a reading list. Then keep learning throughout the school year and keep passionately sharing. Know God. Know your subject. Know more than you did last year. How can you model excellence? Know your students. Have you read the personal file of the students coming into your class next year? What will you do this summer to prepare to individually help those individuals? It's June. Isn't that awesome? We can think about next year already. We can already start praying for those students. How many students' lives I've seen changed through prayer? Nothing I did. I'm thinking of one boy right now. I prayed for him for all summer long, and he came back, and he was a different boy. He had gone to camp, and God worked in his life. I also love the emphasis here at LBS that we have on visiting in the homes, and Dr. R. touched on that. Visit in the homes, write notes. Many of you do that. Many of you have a million stories like this one. I went out to visit an eighth grader. She lives with her grandparents quite a distance away. My husband and I went out. His role is he takes the plate of cookies. So we get to the door. He takes the plate of cookies, knock on the door. When we're walking up the sidewalk, we hear somebody singing. She opens the door. It's my student. She's got a music stand set up in the living room. I didn't know, but God has blessed her wonderfully with the ability to sing. She loves to write songs, write poems. All over the walls, there were pictures that she had painted. The next day in class, I looked over there, second seat, third row. That wasn't just second seat, third row anymore. That girl was a person, and I knew her, and she knew that I cared about her. And so guess what? Throughout the semester, she brought me little poems she had written. One she wrote about me that was just adorable. She came with prayer requests. You say, oh, that's cute, Mrs. Demergen, but really, how does such a visit create a culture of excellence? Think about it. When your students know that you care, they'll pay more attention to you. When they pay more attention, they'll want to please you, not disappoint you. As they pay more attention, they're going to excel because they're going to work harder, and they're going to excel academically. But more importantly, you're going to be able to direct their heart because it's soft toward you, toward the God that you walk with. What about their parents and their grandparents? Talk about a win-win. Show them you care. But not just that. Let's go on to how can we model excellence? Know how to make your subject relevant. Last summer, I met a 25-year-old guy who had a couple of associate degrees, and we were talking. In the course of our conversation, I told him that I teach history and I love it. And he just had one of those looks on his face, and I knew it was coming. And he goes, be honest, history? I just never got it. And my head went, oh, I feel so sorry for him. But then I thought, how many of my students would say that? Am I just teaching students to memorize dates and facts so they get an A on the test or a C minus? Or do they know the relevance of what I'm teaching? It was just that next week I was in Bible school, and in Bible school my role was to pass out volunteer badges for the volunteers. So a lot of my former students would come up and get their badges, you know, for me. So as they would come up, I would say, okay, you have to answer a history question before you get your badge. Oh, great. Teacher wants a teacher, always a teacher. So they came up, and I said, name three presidents that were shot. And of course, they'd be like, Abraham Lincoln, John F. Kennedy. You know, and then it took a while for them to get somebody else. After that, a couple other adults that were standing at the table, at the counter with me, said, we never knew that Ronald Reagan got shot. And I went, how could you not know that? Ronald Reagan got shot in 1981 and you didn't know that? Oh, maybe your teacher was so busy covering the material that they didn't have time to tell you that story that went with Ronald Reagan. Or maybe your teacher is so obsessed with the Civil War that she never got to chapter 40. Or maybe she spent so much time on World War II that when she got to chapter 40, she had one day to cover it. That happened in 1981. Or maybe their teacher told the story and they just forgot that fun story of how when Ronald Reagan got shot and he was being wheeled into the emergency room, down the hall, I guess, to the operating room, not to the emergency room, but to the operating room, his wife came in and he said, honey, I forgot to duck. And then when he was there on the operating table, he looked up at the doctors and said, I hope you're all Republicans. Some of them might have remembered that. They might have gone home and told their parents, yay! But really, even still, what's the relevance of that? Did I really engage them in any critical thinking by telling those fun stories, which I do love to tell? How could I make them think? What if I ask, give me a positive result of Reagan getting shot? Okay, he didn't die, in case you wondered. What could be a positive result of Reagan getting shot? Here's an... Go ahead.
He gets a sick leave.
He gets what?
Sick leave.
He gets sick leave. That's not what I was thinking of. But you know what? I would probably say, whoa, yeah, he did. No, just briefly. He went right back to the White House. And the day he went back to the White House... This is what he wrote in his journal. I know it's going to be a long recovery. Whatever happens now, I owe my life to God and will try to serve him every way I can. Oh. I just made him think, and we can have a little discussion about purpose in life. How about another one? Reagan gained political capital because he was shot and responded so well. What I mean by that is the American people were astonished and inspired by Reagan's strength, grace, and humor in the midst of crisis. And he was able to get some of his conservative agenda passed in those first few months because he gained political capital. We could stop and talk about negative results. I won't go there for time's sake, but making students think. I told you about the 25-year-old who didn't get history. Let me tell you one of my more favorite stories about a seventh grader. He walked into class. It was the end of the year, and it was one of the days he got there early. And as he's standing there, he said, Mrs. Demergen, I really liked history this year. I went, yes, why? And he said, it just all fit together. I said, really? Wow, you know, and obviously 3 years later, I'm still remembering this event because it really hit me. He got it. It all fit together. You see, making students realize that the subject is relevant involves contextual thinking and big picture thinking. How does what you're teaching fit together in math, in science, in English, in history, in cooking? There are causes and effects. Parts make up a whole. People and processes matter. In our attempt to cover the material, let's not forget big picture thinking. As we attempt to model excellence, another way is through cross-curriculum thinking. This can sometimes be difficult because we're very busy. We have lives outside of the classroom that are very ministry-oriented. I think in some ways public school educators are doing a better job at this than we are. What do I mean by cross-curriculum thinking? Mrs. Jones teaches English, 10th grade. She's teaching English, 10th grade, list of vocabulary words. All right? Next door, Miss Suttle is. She's going to have the 10th graders next hour. She teaches Spanish. She happens to use a couple of those vocabulary words in Spanish. Next day, Brother Jones teaches 10th grade world history. He incorporates a couple of those same vocabulary words in his world history lecture. On Friday, Brother Dolphin uses a few of those words in his Bible lesson. What happens? The students all of a sudden see relevance to their vocabulary list, and that the contextual thinking is there. So when we're talking about cross-curriculum thinking, we're thinking about a conscious awareness of what is going on in the classroom next door. Not just that, but also a conscious attentiveness to what will be taught and expected of these same students next year, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. Isaiah 28:10 says, "For precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little, there a little." Cross-curriculum thinking. Awareness of what's going on in the classroom next door, conscious attentiveness to what's going to be taught in the future. last fall, I showed our elementary, junior high, and high school teachers an advanced placement U.S. history test. Okay? And they looked at it, and that was so fun because I asked them, I said, now look at this advanced placement test and tell how you could help prepare your students, whether they're in second grade or eighth grade, for this kind of thinking that's required on this test. And they started, you know, shooting out all these ideas. We could use a political cartoon in fifth grade. Second grade, we could show a graph and make the students analyze the graph. We could have little excerpts from documents down there in fourth grade that they could read and have to understand and comprehend and analyze that document. Visuals, all appropriate for the age level that you're teaching. Age level appropriateness brings me to the last point as we talk about modeling excellence. When we're modeling excellence, what do we want to do? We want to know and show what excellence looks like for your students. Show them. It will totally enhance your teaching. If you require the students to write a story, first grade story, write a first grade story for them and read it to them. If you're going to have a science project, don't just give them the list of requirements. Bring in a hard copy of a science experiment with the board all done, exactly what excellence looks like, and show it to them. I've done this with my high school students. I've done it with my college students. I'll give them an essay. I'll give them the essay question before the test. I'll say, this is going to be the question on the test tomorrow. Be prepared for it. Let me show you what I'm looking for. And I'll give them a similar essay question and give them an answer, which includes a thesis sentence and topics and supporting sentences and paragraphs so they know what excellence looks like. It has changed the level of work I'm getting from my students, whether it be in the high school or in the college. So know and show what excellence looks like. You know, if we're going to have them do a speech, if we're going to have them do a current event, a book report, you do one with the same requirements that you're requiring of them. It's easier to give them a list of requirements. It's easy just to hand that to them. It's less time consuming. But listen to what Titus 2:7 says. In all things, showing thyself a pattern of good works. Well, as we seek to create a culture of biblical excellence, we want to model excellence. But that's not all. Let's go to our next point. Let me review these first. How can we model excellence? Say them with me. Know God. Know your subject. Know more than last year. Know your students. Know how to make your subject relevant and make sure that they know how it's relevant. And then know and show what excellence looks like for your students. So what can we do as we're creating this culture of excellence? Not only model excellence, but expect excellence. What should be included in this expectation? First of all, control. Control of ourselves. Robert E. Lee stated, I cannot trust a man to control others who cannot control himself. Years ago, I was in my classroom in another school, and outside some students were at their lockers, and they were talking, and I overheard their conversation, and one of the students said, look out for, and they named a teacher. She's in another bad mood. Are you easily angered? And the students know it. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance, self-control. We need that Holy Spirit's control of our lives daily. We need control of ourselves. We need control of our classrooms. How do you create a classroom that's excellent in its control? It starts before the students enter. Your classroom should be orderly. It should be welcoming. And when they enter, that's where this control begins. How do you let the students enter? High-fiving, talking loudly, bringing in a Coke. What are they allowed? When my students walk in, I expect them to say, good morning, Mrs. Demergen. Oh, good morning, Reese. How are you? Look them in the eye. I expect them to look me in the eye. Whether it be high school or college. Train them. You're setting the controlled room right there. You're also teaching them how to talk to adults. how we let the students enter. Homeroom. Don't waste homeroom. That's 5 minutes of valuable time. Couldn't you ask them yesterday, what did you learn that meets these objectives? If you're consciously aware of the objectives and you're teaching your students to be aware of what your goals are, they'll be able to mention something that they learned yesterday that actually was one of those objectives. And they'll all of a sudden see, they'll be aware, I am thinking, I am learning in my classroom. Make thinking visible. Expect excellence and control of yourselves and your classroom. What else should be expected is clarity. Clarity from yourself and from your students. Make sure the students and the parents know and understand your expectations. Give clear directions. Always attempt to provide your expectations in print. Think clearly. This summer, you have the time to develop a really good syllabus that you can hand out and have them sign and their parents sign. Then you're helping the parents as well. What are your expectations? Be clear when giving a writing assignment. Show them the rubric. I almost always give a rubric how I'm going to grade. How many points are going to come off if you don't have a thesis? How many points are going to come off if you don't have the topic sentences? How many points are going to come if you don't have a show both sides of the argument? Show the rubric before you collect their assignment so they can actually be looking at it. Expect clarity from yourself, but also from your students. When they ask or answer a question, require individuals to speak so that the whole class can easily hear. Audible speech is courteous and helps with classroom control and continuity. When students answer a question, have them avoid using pronouns. Have them answer with a complete sentence. Require this in oral and in written assignments. Remember, we're thinking about a culture of learning. And although this is hard to train in elementary, and sometimes I feel so badly because the elementary teachers work really hard to train this, and then the junior high teacher or the high school teacher lets it slide. Let's not be like that. Let's be consistent throughout, and I'm about to come to that, because excellence in control, in clarity, and consistency. We're a culture, not an island. Consistency creates security. Students today need security more than ever. Consistency can be characterized in several ways. Say only what you mean and mean what you say. Be predictable. Make sure students know their boundaries. Students really feel good about someone that they cannot manipulate. Be consistent with the rules you set for your classroom. Be predictable with the school policies. If the school has a policy about laptops or dress code or makeup work or phone usage, be consistent in your classroom. When we're talking about consistency, be punctual with administrative responsibilities. If you as a teacher are told to turn in your lesson plans before 8 on Friday morning, turn in your lesson plans before 8 on Friday morning. Consistency is crucial if you want excellence in your classroom. What can we do to create a school culture of biblical excellence? Well, we've said we can model excellence, we can expect excellence, and our last point is foster excellence. What does it mean to foster excellence? A couple things. First of all, when we're fostering excellence, that means to help or to encourage or to uplift. We want to eradicate myths. Get rid of them. Like this one. Students from homes with English as a second language can't succeed. False. Number two, students can't be good athletes or good musicians or hold a job or engage in ministry and excel academically. False. That's my favorite. Students who excel academically don't have any fun. Are you kidding me? We need to show the students that students who excel academically, who can learn how to build a robot or write a great thesis, that's really fun. There's enjoyment in that. And I wish we had time to just stop and talk about showing students what real fun is. Real fun isn't extra time at recess. Real fun isn't having a party with pop and candy. Real fun is learning. But we've got to show them that. What can we do to foster excellence? We can eradicate myths, educate parents. We have to let the parents in on what we're trying to do. That requires communication. It requires phone calls and letters and visits. Show them what we're trying to help their student achieve. They're more likely to come alongside us if we educate them. We also not only want to eradicate myths and educate parents, but we want to enable success. We've already mentioned it. How are you planning this summer to help new or struggling students in your room? Talk to last year's teacher. Find out who the struggling student is. Then go visit their home. I know of a teacher who did this. I'm thinking right now of someone who went and knew there was, she was a new teacher. She knew there was a struggling student. She went and talked to the parent. Started early helping that struggling student before the school year began. What a relationship was built. And that student was able to have success. That takes time this summer. Eradicate myths, educate parents, enable success, and then establish and enlarge the student vision. Last summer, I was talking to an incoming seventh grader. She told me that she really liked math and science. She's a seventh grader. I said, oh, I told her all about AP calculus. And I said, really work hard to get the fundamentals of math and science in seventh and eighth grade so that you can take the harder courses in the AP calculus. And her eyes were shining. I had a fifth grader come up to me just a couple weeks ago and say, I can't wait to take AP history. He's in fifth grade, but already his teacher must have mentioned about AP history and how much fun it will be. When you establish and enlarge the student vision, you'll find out that the students have a goal. And students with a goal are easy to motivate. They're more likely to take ownership for their education. I had a student tell me last year, he said, Mrs. DeMergen, you don't have to reward me for doing my homework. It's what I'm supposed to do. He got it. He was taking ownership. He knew that God's call for his life right now, his heart for God was to be a good student. It's what they want to do because they know in your class what is happening in class is relevant and important. Last point on fostering excellence. How do we do it? Eradicate myths, educate parents, enable success, establish an enlarged vision, emanate optimism. After all, it is God which worketh in us, both to will and to do of his good pleasure. Last night, Pastor Chapel said it. He, Jesus, is the builder. That takes a load off me. He's the builder. He wants to use me. I hope today in this session that you've come away with maybe just one or two ideas that will help you go back to your school and create a culture of biblical excellence. And in that I mean a place where teachers, parents, and students are all consciously thinking and seeking to attain biblical objectives. Have a great day.